something? Perception often swings from flawless to hopeless. The pendulum careens from one extreme to the other, spending almost no time at the happy medium, and rather little in the range of reasonableness. First there's denial, and then there's capitulation. The world is full of positive and negative events, and on most days, we see some of each. And some of the events that occur are ambiguous, having elements of both good and bad, making them subject to either positive or negative interpretation. Take the example of the second cartoon. Low interest rates are good because they stimulate business activity and increase the discounted present value of future cash flows. But they're also bad, since the stronger business activity they abet can give rise to inflation and thus signal the central banks that rates should be raised, withdrawing stimulus from the economy. Interpretation may not fluctuate between the extremes several times a day, as the cartoon suggests, but it does fluctuate excessively, and in fact, it can turn on a dime. A few years ago, my friend John Brooks supplied this great illustration of skewed interpretation at work. Here's how investors react to events when they're feeling good about life, which usually means the market has been rising. Strong data? Economy strengthening, stocks rally. Weak data, Fed likely to ease, stocks rally. Data as expected, low volatility, stocks rally. Banks make $4 billion, business conditions favorable, stocks rally. Banks lose $4 billion, bad news out of the way, stocks rally. Oil spikes, growing global economy contributing to demand, stocks rally. Oil drops, more purchasing power for the consumer, stocks rally. Dollar plunges, great for exporters, stocks rally. Dollar strengthens, great for companies that buy from abroad, stocks rally. Inflation spikes will cause assets to appreciate, stocks rally. Inflation drops, improves quality of earnings, stocks rally. Of course, the same behavior also applies in the opposite direction. When psychology is negative and markets have been falling for a while, everything is capable of being interpreted negatively. Strong economic data is seen as likely to make the Fed withdraw stimulus by raising interest rates, and weak data is taken to mean companies will have trouble meeting earnings forecasts. In other words, it's not the data or events, it's the interpretation, and that fluctuates with swings in psychology. At the greatest extremes of the pendulum's swing, a process can take on the appearance of a virtuous circle or a vicious circle. When events are predominantly positive and psychology is rosy, negative developments tend to be overlooked. Everything is interpreted favorably, and things are often thought to be incapable of taking a turn for the worse. The logic supporting an expectation of further advances appears irresistible. Past constraints and norms are ignored or rationalized away, and anyone imagining limitations on the positive future is dismissed as an old fogey lacking imagination. The potential for gains comes to be viewed as infinite. Asset prices rise, encouraging further optimism. But on the other hand, when things have been going badly for months or years, and psychology is highly negative, it's the potential for improvement that can be forgotten. Unpleasant events are emphasized and positive ones are ignored. The case for further deterioration seems rock solid. Its error can't be imagined. And now it's the downside that seems to be unlimited. Prices fall, resulting in further pessimism. The virtuous circle and the vicious circle are both unrealistic exaggerations. While they've been dreamed up many times in the past, they've never proved out. But that fact doesn't enable most people to resist them while they're rampant. Again, the superior investor, who resists external influences, remains emotionally balanced and acts rationally, perceives both positive and negative events, weighs events objectively, and analyzes them dispassionately. But the truth is that sometimes euphoria and optimism cause most investors to view things more positively than is warranted. And sometimes depression and pessimism make them see only bad and interpret events with a negative cast. Refusing to do so is one of the keys to successful investing. For a bullish phase to hold sway, the environment has to be characterized by greed, optimism, exuberance, confidence, credulity, daring, risk tolerance, and aggressiveness. But these traits will not govern a market forever. Eventually, they will give way to fear, pessimism, prudence, uncertainty, skepticism, caution, risk aversion, and reticence. Busts are the product of booms, and I'm convinced it's usually more correct to attribute a bust to the excesses of the preceding boom than to the specific event that sets off the correction. Now what? January 2008. Usually, when either set of polar extremes is in the ascendancy, that fact is readily observable, and thus the implications for investors should be obvious to objective observers. But of course, the swing of the market pendulum to one extreme or the other occurs for the simple reason that the psyches of most market participants are moving in the same direction in a herd-like fashion. Few of the people involved, actually, are objective. To continue a thread from my memo, Everyone Knows, April 2007, expecting widespread clinical observation during a market mania makes about as much sense as saying, everyone knows the market has gone too far. If many people recognized that it had gone too far, it wouldn't be there. It's all good. July 2007. Chapter 8. The Cycle in Attitudes Toward Risk. The rational investor is diligent, skeptical, and appropriately risk-averse at all times, but also on the lookout for opportunities for potential return that more than compensates for risk. That's the ideal. But in good times, we hear most people say, risk? What risk? I don't see much that could go wrong. Look how well things have been going. And anyway, risk is my friend. The more risk I take, the more money I'm likely to make. Then in bad times, they switch to something simpler. I don't care if I ever make another penny in the market. I just don't want to lose anymore. Get me out! Now that we've moved on from considering cycles in the abstract to discussing their operation in the investment world, I'm going to provide a brief aside regarding the fundamental nature of investing in order to establish a foundation for the discussion that will follow. Some of this, admittedly, will be familiar from earlier chapters. What is investing? One way to think of it is as bearing risk in pursuit of profit. Investors try to position portfolios so as to profit from future developments rather than be penalized by them. The superior investor is simply someone who does this better than others. Do we know what will happen in the future? Some investors think they do, or think they have to act as if they do, because if they don't, they'll lose their jobs and their clients. Or they have been pursuing profit through forecasts for so long that they've brainwashed themselves into believing it's possible to be right about the future, and have become conditioned to ignore their low past success rates. Other investors, the smarter, more self-aware ones, I think, understand that the future isn't knowable with certainty. They may form opinions regarding future events, but they don't bet heavily that those opinions will prove correct. Since A, investing consists of dealing with the future, but B, the future isn't knowable, that's where the risk in investing comes from. If future events were predictable, investing would be easy, and profit would be sure. The general level of returns might be low in that case because so little risk is involved. That's a topic for another day. But the fact that events aren't predictable introduces risk. Because the events that actually occur may be different than those that were predicted, or the market's reaction to events may differ from what was expected, a portfolio may be positioned incorrectly for the future that unfolds. Since risk, that is, uncertainty with regard to future developments and the possibility of bad outcomes, is the primary source of the challenge in investing, the ability to understand, assess, and deal with risk is the mark of the superior investor and an essential, I'm tempted to say the essential, requirement for investment success. Finally, as to foundation, it's important to recognize that while the investment environment varies over time, at any particular point in time, it is a given. What I mean is that we can accept the environment as it is and invest, or we can reject it and stay on the sidelines. But we don't have a third option of saying, I don't like the environment as it is today. I demand a different one. Or rather, we can demand another, but of course, that won't make it materialize. My view that risk is the main moving piece in investing makes me conclude that at any given point in time, the way investors collectively are viewing risk and behaving with regard to it is of overwhelming importance in shaping the investment environment in which we find ourselves. And the state of the environment is key in determining how we should behave with regard to risk at that point. Assessing where attitudes toward risk stand in their cycle is what this chapter is about, perhaps the most important one in this book. One of the luckiest breaks I received in my lifetime came in the form of the opportunity to attend the University of Chicago's Graduate School of Business, since renamed the Booth School, in 1967 to 69. I, like many people in those days, went straight from college to graduate school, perhaps as the most efficient route to success, but with the added incentive provided by the Vietnam War and accompanying draft. Over the four prior years, I had received a nuts-and-bolts education in finance at Wharton, practical, non-theoretical, and qualitative. My choice of graduate school was most fortuitous, as Chicago had just begun to teach a new theory of finance and investment that had been developed largely there in the early 1960s. Thus, my Wharton training was paired with, or rather juxtaposed against, further study in finance that was almost entirely academic, theoretical, and quantitative. Soon after arriving in Chicago, I was exposed to a graphic that provided much of the foundation for the new theory of investment, and that has served as the starting point for much of my thinking and writing ever since. This graphic has become ubiquitous in the investment world in the time since my first exposure to it, 50 years ago. Its essence lies in the fact that the line slopes up and to the right, indicating a positive relationship between risk and return. This is usually misinterpreted, in my view, as meaning riskier assets produce higher returns, and thus, if you want to make more money, the answer is to take more risk. This formulation cannot be correct, since if riskier assets could be counted on to produce higher returns, they by definition wouldn't be riskier. The linearity with which the relationship between risk and return is presented in the graphic ignores the fact that at every level of risk, there is a range of potential outcomes regarding return, and thus it overstates the reliability of the relationship. That's what makes people say riskier investments produce higher returns. Instead, I think the graphic should be interpreted as saying, investments that seem riskier have to appear to promise higher returns, or else no one will make them. Words like seem and appear are the right ones, since they indicate that risk and potential return can only be estimated, and that the investment world doesn't work like a machine. That makes those words highly appropriate, actually compelling, for use when discussing investing. For a more thorough discussion, see Chapter 5 of The Most Important Thing. People who immediately get concepts like risk and risk return usually have an intuitive sense that prepares them to be good investors. I hope the reasons behind my interpretation of the graphic will become immediately clear once I have prompted you to think about it. Let's suppose a logical investor is offered two investments with the same expected return, but in one case the return is virtually assured and in the other it is highly uncertain. We would expect him to choose the former, since most people prefer certainty over uncertainty. If a treasury bond and a high-tech startup both seemed likely to return 7%, for example, the vast majority of people would go with the treasury. Why take the extra risk associated with the startup if no potential increase in return is offered to compensate for the incremental risk? Well, that's the point. Most people would prefer a sure 7% over a possible 7%. In other words, most people are risk-averse. That's the essential assumption that underlies the Chicago School of Finance. To describe risk aversion, I say most people prefer safety and disprefer risk, even though I've never seen the word disprefer in a dictionary. There's a big difference of opinion regarding the propriety of that word, with the linguistic establishment railing against it. But I think it's a great word. If it doesn't exist, it should. The widespread dislike for risk and the resultant insistence on incremental potential return, if incremental risk is to be borne, are the reasons why long-term treasuries carry higher yields than short-term treasuries, why high-yield bonds promise higher returns than investment-grade bonds, why stocks are generally expected to return more than bonds, and why venture capital investing is expected to provide higher returns than public stocks. Note that I'm only talking here about expectations and promises, or what may happen or should happen, rather than things that will happen or are sure to happen. But that expectation of incremental return generally has to be present in order for most people to voluntarily take on added risk. Because of the natural dispreference for risk, it's entirely reasonable to expect that if they're going to bear it, investors have to be induced through the possibility of an incremental reward. Non-daredevils will do risky things only if they expect a generous reward for doing so. Nothing else makes sense. Risk aversion is an essential element in investing. People's aversion to loss causes them to police the markets. Because most people are averse to risk, they approach investing with caution. They perform careful analysis when considering investments, and especially risky ones. They incorporate conservative assumptions and appropriate skepticism into their analysis. They demand greater margins of safety on risky investments to protect against analytical errors and unpleasant surprises. They insist on healthy risk premiums, the expectation of incremental returns, if they're going to undertake risky investments, and they refuse to invest in deals that make no sense. These are all essential parts of the investment process. Because risk-averse investors perform them, investing is a rational field in which reasonable propositions are offered. In short, risk aversion is the main element that keeps markets safe and sane. Please note, however, that the above is a normative description, or a description of how things should be. These are things the superior investor does, and that all investors should do. But the bottom line is that not everyone does them, and certainly not all investors do them equally at all times. It's one of the absolute truths that attitudes toward risk change, and in so doing, they alter the investment environment. That's what the rest of this chapter will be about. Here's another aside. How is the investment environment formed? In short, it is the result of discussions that take place in the marketplace, either within each investor's consciousness or among investors, spoken or signaled through their actions. Here's how I described the creation of the investment environment in Risk and Return Today, in October 2004. I'll use a typical market of a few years back to illustrate how this works in real life. The interest rate on the 30-day T-bill might have been 4%. So, an investor says, if I'm going to go out 5 years, I want 5%. And to buy the 10-year note, I have to get 6%. He demands a higher rate to extend maturity because he's concerned about the risk to purchasing power, a risk that is assumed to increase with time to maturity. That's why the yield curve, which in reality is a portion of the capital market line, normally slopes upward with the increase in asset life. Now let's factor in credit risk. If the 10-year treasury pays 6%, I'm not going to buy a 10-year single-A corporate unless I'm promised 7%. This introduces the concept of credit spreads. Our hypothetical investor wants 100 basis points to go from a govy to a corporate. If the consensus of investors feels the same, That's what the spread will be. What if we depart from investment-grade bonds? I'm not going to touch a high-yield bond unless I get 600 over a treasury note of comparable maturity. So, high-yield bonds are required to yield 12% for a spread of 6% over the treasury note, if they're going to attract buyers. Now, let's leave fixed income altogether. Things get tougher because you can't look anywhere to find the prospective return on investments like stocks. That's because, simply put, their returns are conjectural, not fixed. But investors have a sense for these things. Historically, S&P stocks have returned 10%, and I'll only buy them if I think they're going to keep doing so. So in theory, the common stock investor determines earnings per share, earnings growth rate and dividend payout ratio, and inputs them into a valuation model to arrive at the price from which S&P stocks will return 10%, although I'm not sure the process is nearly that methodical in actuality. And riskier stocks should return more. I won't buy on the NASDAQ unless I think I'm going to get 13%. From there, it's onward and upward. If I can get 10% from stocks, I need 15% to accept the illiquidity and uncertainty associated with real estate, and 25% if I'm going to invest in buyouts, and 30% to induce me to go for venture capital with its low success ratio. That's the way it's supposed to work, and in fact, I think it generally does, although the requirements aren't the same at all times. The result is a capital market line of the sort that has become familiar to many of us. The process results in the formation of the risk-return continuum, or capital market line. The process establishes the general level of return relative to risk, as well as the quantum of incremental promised return, or the risk premium, that will be expected for the bearing of incremental risk. In a rational world, the result will be as follows. Investments that seem riskier will be priced so that they appear to offer higher returns. The increase in return per unit of incremental risk will be reasonable and appropriate. The increase in expected return generally will appear to be consistently proportional to the incremental risk. That is, bearing a unit of incremental risk at one point on the continuum will appear likely to bring the same amount of incremental return as bearing a similar unit of incremental risk elsewhere on the continuum. Thus, there won't be particular points on the continuum where risk-bearing is rewarded much more or much less than at others. That is, investments whose promised risk-adjusted return is obviously superior to the rest. In a rational world, any violations of these provisions would cause capital to move such that the prices of mispriced assets are bid up or pushed down. As a result, the violations would be corrected. All investments would offer risk-adjusted returns that are fair relative to each other, and investors could increase their returns only by increasing the amount of risk they bear. If investors always behaved that way, their actions would cause the world to be marked by efficient markets, where no investment offers a better risk-adjusted return than any other. Of course, markets don't always operate as they're supposed to. Things certainly aren't always priced right, but the general suggestion of efficiency is too logical to be disregarded. Market efficiency is another essential topic, but I won't go into it further. See Chapter 2 of The Most Important Thing, as well as the latter half of Getting Lucky, from January 2014. The key thing to note is that fluctuations in attitudes toward risk can cause exceptions to the principles described here. Sometimes investors become too risk-averse, and sometimes they relax their risk aversion and become too risk-tolerant. When positive events occur, as described in the last chapter, and euphoria, optimism, and greed rise, investors tend to become less risk-averse than usual and less risk-averse than they should be. What are the effects? Since they feel better about the environment and are more optimistic about likely outcomes, they reduce the amount of caution they bring to the investing process. Since they no longer consider investing to be risky, they don't see the need for painstaking analysis. They tend to make assumptions that are more generous and they replace skepticism with credulousness. They're willing to make do with a reduced margin of safety. Viewing risk as less worrisome, they no longer demand risk premiums as cushy as in the past. They behave less as sticklers, since they're more attracted to the returns on risky investments and less leery of the risk they involve. It is for these reasons that, as you'll see in the next chapter, the shakiest financings are completed in the most buoyant economies and financial markets. Good times cause people to become more optimistic, jettison their caution, and settle for skimpy risk premiums on risky investments. Further, since they are less pessimistic and less alarmed, they tend to lose interest in the safer end of the risk-return continuum. This combination of elements makes the prices of risky assets rise relative to safer assets. Thus, it shouldn't come as a surprise that more unwise investments are made in good times than in bad. This happens even though the higher prices on risky investments may mean the prospective risk premiums offered for making those riskier investments are skimpier than they were in more risk-conscious times. The reduced insistence on adequate risk premiums causes the slope of the capital market line to flatten. Going back to high school geometry, we recall that the slope of a line on a graph is the distance traveled on the vertical axis per unit change along the horizontal axis. The slope of the capital market line reflects the amount of incremental potential return that is offered per unit of incremental risk borne. Thus, it is a direct indication of the degree of risk aversion present in the market. In times of obliviousness toward risk, or high risk tolerance, the reduced demand in terms of risk premiums causes the slope of the line to flatten and the amount of risk compensation to shrink. The lower slope of the capital market line means, by definition, that there's less of a return increment per unit increase in risk. In simpler terms, the payoff for risk-bearing is subpar. In my opinion, all of the above follows logically from direct observation. The process is as follows. Positive events lead to increased optimism. Increased optimism makes people more risk-tolerant. An increase in risk tolerance causes lower risk premiums to be demanded. A reduction in demanded risk premiums equates to lower demanded returns on risky assets. A reduction of demanded returns on risky assets causes their prices to rise, and higher prices make assets even riskier, but also attract buying on the part of momentum investors who chase rising stocks. It follows from the above that risk is high when investors feel risk is low, and risk compensation is at a minimum just when risk is at a maximum, meaning risk compensation is most needed. So much for the rational investor. For me, the bottom line of all of this is that the greatest source of investment risk is the belief that there is no risk. Widespread risk tolerance, or a high degree of investor comfort with risk, is the greatest harbinger of subsequent market declines. But because most investors are following the progression described just above, this is rarely perceived at the time when perceiving it, and turning cautious is most important. Since the other side of the coin should be obvious, I won't belabor it, but I will take a minute to talk about what happens when the downward swing of the cycle in attitudes toward risk makes investors more risk-averse. One of the most important characteristics of psychological cycles is their extremeness. Cycles swing not only in directions and degrees that make sense, but also in wacky ways and to excess. For example, investors gang up from time to time and say, "Let's disregard risk. We'll all get rich." Their ardor and excitement cause them to bid prices to levels that are so high and to accept tales that clearly are so unrealistic that after the fact it would be laughable if the damage done weren't so great. And after they have committed these sins of excess and lost a lot of money in the resultant downswing toward greater prudence, they castigate themselves for their excesses of greed and credulousness. They wonder how they could have behaved so foolishly. They confess that they never really understood the exotic and exciting investment activities in which they had engaged, and they vow never to do it again. Just as the inadequacy of their risk aversion allowed them to push prices up and buy at the top, egged on by the vision of easy money in a world in which they couldn't discern any risk, now they push prices down and sell at the bottom. Their unpleasant recent experience convinces them, contrary to what they had thought when everything was going well, that investing is a risky field in which they shouldn't engage. And as a consequence, their risk aversion goes all the way from inadequate to excessive. Given their recent painful experience and the negativity they've developed about what lies ahead, they amp up their caution. Since they now associate investing with loss rather than profit, their process comes to emphasize the avoidance of further loss over prospecting for opportunity. They ensure that their assumptions are conservative enough to rule out all potential for disappointment, and they apply extreme skepticism. They find it impossible to identify, even to imagine, investments that offer an adequate margin of safety. Since they see risk everywhere, they consider even the current swollen risk premiums insufficient. They become worrywarts. Just as risk tolerance had positioned them to become buyers of overpriced assets at the highs, now their screaming risk aversion makes them sellers, certainly not buyers, at the bottom. That's the point. Under these circumstances, the perception of risk is exaggerated, and the slope of the capital market line becomes excessive. In precisely the reverse of my description of the flat capital market line, the higher slope of this one means the expected return increment per unit increase in risk is unusually generous. This is a risk-averse market, and it offers an exaggerated payoff for risk-bearing. Thus, the reward for bearing incremental risk is greatest at just the moment when, no, rather, just because people absolutely refuse to bear it. As risk attitudes swing from high to low, so do opportunities for profit or loss. When everything's going well and asset prices are soaring, investors tend to view the future as rosy, risk as their friend, and profit as easily achieved. Everyone feels the same, meaning little risk aversion is incorporated in prices, and thus, they're precarious. Investors become risk tolerant just when they should increase their risk aversion. And when events are down, so are investors. They think of the markets as a place to lose money, risk as something to be avoided at all cost, and losses as depressingly likely. As I described at the end of the last chapter, under the excess of caution that prevails, A, no one will accept possibilities that incorporate any optimism at all, and B, they likewise cannot countenance the possibility that an assumption could be too bad to be true. Just as risk tolerance is unlimited at the top, it is non-existent at the bottom. This negativity causes prices to fall to levels from which losses are highly unlikely and gains could be enormous. But the sting of the prior declines tends to increase risk aversion and send investors to the sidelines, just as prices, and thus risk, are at their lowest. I'd like to provide a real-life example of changing attitudes with the benefit of some quantification taken from The Happy Medium, July 2004. The prevalence of risk tolerance, or risk obliviousness, in the late 1990s was clear. I personally heard a prominent brokerage house strategist say, "Stocks are overpriced, but not enough to keep them from being a buy." And we all heard the man on the street say, "I'm up so much in my 401k, it wouldn't bother me if it fell by a third." Where was that guy 2 or 3 years later? No, those risk-tolerant attitudes will not persist forever. Eventually, something will intrude, exposing securities' imperfections and too high prices. Prices will decline. Investors will like them less at $60 than they did at $100. Fear of losing the remaining $60 will overtake the urge to make back the lost $40. Risk aversion eventually will reassert itself, and usually go to excess. How about some quantification of this cycle? In mid-1998, just before the collapse of long-term capital management brought investors other than techies to their senses, Only $12.5 billion of non-defaulted bonds yielded more than 20%, one possible threshold for the label distressed debt. Because investors weren't very worried about risk, they demanded ultra-high returns from relatively few non-defaulted bonds. The word blithe might best describe their attitude. But long-term's demise awakened investors to the existence of risk, and a year later, the amount of bonds yielding more than 20% had more than tripled to $38.7 billion. By mid-2002, when the corporate scandals held the debt market in a grip of terror, the 20% yielders had grown to $105.6 billion, 8.5 times the level just 4 years earlier. Risk aversion had come a long way from inadequate, and as later events showed, had become excessive. By March 31, 2004, this figure had fallen 85%, back to just $16.2 billion. Risk aversion had subsided, and possibly had become inadequate again. I'm sure that fundamentals didn't fluctuate anywhere near the degree reflected in prices, yields, and thus the distressed debt tally. As usual, reality was greatly exaggerated by swings in psychology. When investors in general are too risk-tolerant, security prices can embody more risk than they do return. When investors are too risk-averse, prices can offer more return than risk. The title of the memo cited above, The Happy Medium, was inspired by my mother's wisdom and her constant reminders that we should avoid extremes in behavior. Rather, we should tend toward the middle on most things, toward a reasonable balance between too much and too little. But my experience as an investor convinces me that the happy medium is rarely seen. If you reflect on what I said about the graph of a typical cycle, you may be impressed to find that in stages A, D, and G, cyclical phenomena tend to return from extremes and move toward the more reasonable mean. What a rational thing that is. But then, as I pointed out, it's usually the case that those corrections from extremes continue past the fair midpoint in stages B, E, and H, toward the opposite extreme. A statistician who looks at such a graph will tell you that, on average, the phenomenon charted is at the central value or astride the secular trend. But the rest of us see it as almost always in motion, swinging away from or back toward those midpoints. In fact, it spends about as much time at extreme highs and lows as it does at the happy medium. Most investors' attitude toward risk do the very same. What's the greatest source of investment risk? Does it come from negative economic developments? Corporate events that fall short to forecasts? Companies whose products become uncompetitive? Earnings declines? Low creditworthiness? No. It comes when asset prices attain excessively high levels as a result of some new intoxicating investment rationale that can't be justified on the basis of fundamentals and that causes unreasonably high valuations to be assigned. And when are these prices reached? When risk aversion and caution evaporate and risk tolerance and optimism take over. This condition is the investor's greatest enemy. What happens when risk aversion is insufficient? The global financial crisis of 2007 to 2008 represented the greatest financial downswing of my lifetime, and consequently, it presents the best opportunity to observe, reflect, and learn. The scene was set for its occurrence by a number of developments. Here's a partial list. Government policies supported an expansion of home ownership, which by definition meant the inclusion of people who historically couldn't afford to buy homes, at a time when home prices were soaring. The Fed pushed interest rates down, causing the demand for higher-yielding instruments, such as structured, leveraged mortgage securities, to increase. There was a rising trend among banks to make mortgage loans, package them, and sell them onward, as opposed to retaining them. Decisions to lend, structure, assign credit ratings, and invest were made on the basis of unquestioning extrapolation of low historic mortgage default rates. The above 4 points resulted in an increased eagerness to extend mortgage loans, with an accompanying decline in lending standards. Novel and untested mortgage-backed securities were developed that promised high returns with low risk, something that has great appeal in non-skeptical times. Protective laws and regulations were relaxed, such as the Glass-Steagall Act, which prohibited the creation of financial conglomerates, the uptick rule, which prevented traders who had bet against stocks from forcing them down through non-stop short-selling, and the rules that limited banks' leverage, permitting it to nearly triple. Finally, the media ran articles stating that risk had been eliminated by the combination of the adroit Fed, which could be counted on to inject stimulus whenever economic sluggishness developed, confidence that the excess liquidity flowing to China for its exports and to oil producers would never fail to be recycled back into our markets, buoying asset prices, and the new Wall Street innovations which sliced and diced risk so finely, spread it so widely, and placed it with those best suited to bear it. The existence of all the above elements indicated the presence of risk tolerance. In fact, they couldn't have arisen if risk tolerance hadn't dominated the psyches of investors, lenders, borrowers, and regulators. The existence of risk tolerance, like that seen in the years immediately preceding the crisis, should be very worrisome, as it implies an absence of worry, caution, and skepticism. It is inescapable that these developments, and the risk tolerance or risk obliviousness that was behind them, ultimately would lead to unsafe financial behavior, particularly via the issuance of financial instruments that were unsound and likely to fail. The ability to borrow large amounts of capital at low interest rates caused asset buyers to consider the period a golden age. But it wasn't marked by the availability of sound, bargain-priced investments. Rather, the ready availability of leverage made it easy to invest heavily in assets whose prices had risen a great deal, and in innovative, untested, synthetic, levered investment products, many of which would go on to fail. Perhaps most importantly among the contributing factors, the period was marked by risky behavior on the part of financial institutions. When the world is characterized by benign macro events, hyper-financial activity and financial innovation, there is a tendency for providers of capital to compete for market share in a process I call the race to the bottom. I'll make reference later on to a memo of that name. The mood in the years 2005-07 was summed up by Citigroup CEO Charles Prince in June 2007, virtually on the eve of the global financial crisis, in a statement that became emblematic of the era. When the music stops, in terms of liquidity, things will be complicated, but as long as the music's playing, you've got to get up and dance. We're still dancing. In other words, banks had to do, and were doing, things that depended for their success on the continuation of abnormally favorable conditions. And that would turn into problems if those conditions normalized. But no banker could decline to participate for fear of losing market share. The instruments were untested and potentially defective, but no one was willing to pass up his share. That's the kind of crowd behavior that typifies, creates, and exacerbates cycles. In theory, a bank CEO could have declined to join in this folly, but under the realities of the times, anyone who sat out the dance lost market share and failed to rake in the easy money that his competitors were reaping could be forced out of his job by activist investors. Thus, banks bid aggressively for the opportunity to provide capital as if the music would never stop. But cognizance of cycles makes it clear that eventually it will. This kind of risk tolerance and risk obliviousness plays an essential part in the up phase that precedes and sets the scene for every dramatic down phase. As the period 2005-07 was rolling along, it presented a great opportunity to observe events that made manifest market participants' attitudes toward risk and to reach helpful conclusions. I believe the following excerpt from The Race to the Bottom a memo I wrote on the subject in February 2007, just a few months before the first indication that bad times were coming, provides an excellent example. It demonstrates the potential value of inferences drawn from isolated and perhaps anecdotal experiences. While the last few years have given me many opportunities to marvel at excesses in the capital markets, in this case the one that elicited my battle cry, that calls for a memo, hit the newspapers in England during my last stay. As the Financial Times reported on November 1, 2006, Abbey, the UK's second largest home loans provider, has raised the standard amount it will lend home buyers to 5 times either their single or joint salaries, eclipsing the traditional borrowing levels of around 3.5 times salary. It followed last week's decision by Bank of Ireland Mortgages and Bristol and West to increase standard salary multiples from 4 to 4.5 times. In other words, there had been a traditional rule of thumb saying that borrowers can safely handle mortgages with a face amount equal to 3+ times their salaries. But now they can have 5 times, roughly 50% more. What inference should be drawn? There are at least 4 possibilities. The old standard was too conservative, and the new one's right. Conditions have changed, such that the new standard is as conservative for today as the old one was for its times. It's reasonable for mortgage lenders to accept higher default experience and thus lower net returns because their cost of capital has declined, or the rush to place money has caused a supplier of capital to loosen its standards. Now, I am no expert on the UK mortgage market, and it's my intention in this memo to comment on general capital market trends, not any one sector. Further, it's certainly true that today's lower interest rates mean a given salary can support a bigger mortgage, and that's likely to hold true so long as 1, borrowers keep their jobs, and 2, their mortgages carry fixed rates. But if you think Abby's reason for taking this step might be a logical one like that, the question to ask is, why now? Logical reasons and sober decision-making might be involved here, but so might competition to put out money and the usual late-stage belief that it's different this time. Lenders and investors invariably depart from time-honored disciplines when cycles move to extremes, out of a belief that current conditions are different from those that prevailed in the past, when those disciplines were appropriate, and just as invariably, they're shown that cycles repeat, and nothing really changes. What did we see in the U.S. mortgage market as home prices rose and interest rates declined? First, low teaser rates, then higher loan-to-value ratios, then 100% financing, then low amortization loans, then no amortization loans, then loans requiring no documentation of employment or credit history. All these things made it possible for more buyers to stretch for more expensive homes, but at the same time, they made mortgages riskier for lenders. And these developments took place when home prices were sky-high and interest rates were at multi-generation lows. In the end, buyers took out the biggest mortgage possible given their incomes and prevailing interest rates. Such mortgages would land them in the houses of their dreams and leave them there for as long as conditions didn't deteriorate, which they invariably do. Do you remember the game Bid a Note from the TV show Name That Tune? Contestant X said, I can name that tune in 6 notes. Then contestant Y said, I can name that tune in 5 notes. Then contestant X said, I can name that tune in 4 notes. The contestant who eventually got the chance to guess the name of the tune was the one who was willing to accept the riskiest proposition to try on the basis of the least information. So the Bank of Ireland entered the competition to lend money for home purchases and said, I'll lend 4.5 times the borrower's salary. And Abby said, I'll lend 5 times. The so-called winner in this auction is the one who will put out the most money with the least safety. Whether that's really winning or losing will become clear when the cycle turns, as it did in the U.S. last year. But certainly, there's a race to the bottom going on, a contest to become the institution that'll make loans with the slightest margin for error. Any way you slice it, standards for mortgage loans have dropped in recent years, and risk has increased. Logic-based? Perhaps. Cycle-induced? And exacerbated? I'd say so. The FT quoted John Paul Crutchley, a banking analyst at Merrill Lynch, as saying, "When Abby are lending a multiple of 5 times salary, that could be perfectly sensible, or it could be tremendously risky." Certainly mortgage lending was made riskier. We'll see in a few years whether that was intelligent risk-taking or excessive competitive ardor. Today's financial market conditions are easily summed up. There's a global glut of liquidity, minimal interest in traditional investments, little apparent concern about risk, and skimpy prospective returns everywhere. Thus, as the price for accessing returns that are potentially adequate, but lower than those promised in the past, investors are readily accepting significant risk in the form of heightened leverage, untested derivatives, and weak deal structures. The current cycle isn't unusual in its form, only its extent. There's little mystery about the ultimate outcome, in my opinion. But at this point in the cycle, it's the optimists who look best. As is often the case, I could have made this a shorter memo by simply invoking my 2 favorite quotations, both of which have a place here. The first is from John Kenneth Galbraith, who passed away last year. I was fortunate to be able to spend a few hours with Mr. Galbraith 1.5 years earlier, and to have the benefit of his wisdom firsthand. This quote, once again, is from his invaluable book, A Short History of Financial Euphoria. It seems particularly apt under the current circumstances. Contributing to euphoria are 2 further factors little noted in our time or in past times. The first is the extreme brevity of the financial memory. In consequence, financial disaster is quickly forgotten. In further consequence, when the same or closely similar circumstances occur again, sometimes in only a few years, they are hailed by a new, often youthful, and always supremely self-confident generation as a brilliantly innovative discovery in the financial and larger economic world. There can be few fields of human endeavor in which history counts for so little as in the world of finance. Past experience, to the extent that it is part of memory at all, is dismissed as the primitive refuge of those who do not have the insight to appreciate the incredible wonders of the present. The second is Warren Buffett's bedrock reminder of the need to adjust our financial actions based on the investor behavior playing out around us. Fewer words, but probably even more useful. The less prudence with which others conduct their affairs, the greater the prudence with which we should conduct our own affairs. This memo can be summed up simply. There's a race to the bottom going on, reflecting a widespread reduction in the level of prudence on the part of investors and capital providers. No one can prove at this point that those who participate will be punished, or that their long-run performance won't exceed that of the naysayers. But that is the usual pattern. If you refuse to fall into line in carefree markets like today's, it's likely that for a while you'll A, lag in terms of return, and B, look like an old fogey. But neither of those is much of a price to pay if it means keeping your head and capital when others eventually lose theirs. In my experience, times of laxness have always been followed eventually by corrections in which penalties are imposed. It may not happen this time, but I'll take that risk. In the meantime, Oak Tree and its people will continue to apply the standards that have served us so well over the last 20 years. Warren Buffett puts it well in the above quote. It's the one I use all the time. I think it aptly sums up this phenomenon, as well as the contrarian response that is required as a result. When others fail to worry about risk and fail to apply caution, as Buffett says, we must turn more cautious. But it must also be said that when other investors are panicked and depressed and can't imagine conditions under which risk would be worth taking, we should turn aggressive. What happens when risk aversion is excessive? The symmetry of financial cycles, described at length in Chapter 2, essentially guaranteed that the risk-tolerant environment of 2005 to 07 and the boom in financial instrument issuance that it abetted would be followed by a serious correction, and of course, such a correction materialized. As I said earlier, the global financial crisis of 2007 to 2008 provided what I hope will turn out to be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to witness an irrational swing of the pendulum of emotion to total negativity and a turn of the cycle in attitudes toward risk in the direction of excessive risk aversion. The actions that had been abetted by excessive risk tolerance in 2005 to 2007, as just described, were exposed as having been foolhardy, and as a result, they brought great pain and loss. It became clear that the effort to expand home ownership had led to purchases of homes by many people who couldn't afford them. Thousands lost the money they had put into home equity, along with moving costs and any improvements they made. Subprime mortgages that had been issued without proof of income or employment were shown to have been unwise. Weak mortgage lending practices, along with extensive mortgage fraud that those practices failed to catch, turned out, not surprisingly, to have led to the issuance of many mortgages on which borrowers were unable to make the required payments. The extrapolation of low historic default rates on mortgages turned out to have ignored the possibility that weakened mortgage lending practices would result in defaults at unprecedented rates. Since actual defaults exceeded the historic rates that had been the basis for security structuring decisions, debt ratings and loss projections, structured and levered securities that had been built from subprime mortgages, also defaulted in stunning numbers, proving their high ratings to have been erroneous. Levered mortgage-backed securities and financial derivatives, most of which contain high levels of built-in leverage, generally switched from being return-enhancing tools to weapons of financial mass destruction as levered funds and securities breached loan covenants and issuers ultimately proved unable to service their debt. Of course, the new financial products demonstrated, as usual, that financial innovations promising high returns with low risk rarely keep that promise. As for the relaxed regulations, the financial conglomerates permitted by revocation of the Glass-Steagall Act had extensive problems. The repeal of the uptick rule allowed the stocks of financial institutions to be driven down relentlessly, and several banks proved unable to survive under the high levels of leverage that had been allowed. Because of everything that had gone before, the consequences included massive mortgage defaults and home repossessions, downgradings and failures on the part of mortgage-backed securities, collapsing home prices, and the inability to sell existing homes, collapsing stock and corporate bond markets, and the disappearance of liquidity, a total drying up of credit availability, and failures, bailouts, and bankruptcies at a number of banks. Of course, it's improbable events that brought on the credit crisis. Lots of bad things happened that had been considered unlikely, if not impossible, and they happened at the same time to investors who'd taken on significant leverage. The Limits to Negativism, October 2008. What was the cumulative psychological effect of all of the above on investors and other financial system participants? In short, it scared them to death. When total fear replaces a high degree of confidence, excessive risk aversion takes the place of unrealistic risk tolerance. And that's what happened in late 2008 following the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers. Sellers came forward in droves, exhibiting a high degree of urgency. Buyers took to the sidelines. Asset prices collapsed, and market liquidity went to zero. All these things resulted from the replacement of high risk tolerance with high risk aversion, and they all contributed to still more fear, still more risk aversion, further negative events, and widespread fear of more of the same. The same people who had bought untried instruments on the basis of positive assumptions and promises that were too good to be true, now were convinced that the entire financial system might melt down. To provide an example of the swing toward excessive risk aversion and its impact, I'll share the story of something that happened a few weeks after the Lehman bankruptcy. It's the event that inspired me to write my low point memo quoted above, The Limits to Negativism. Participating to a minor degree in the general trends that were afoot, Oak Tree formed its first levered funds in the years just preceding the crisis,